Have you ever wondered why Christians do not build temples? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author. We're continuing a 13-week series on the New Testament books of 1st and 2nd Peter. My conversation partners throughout this quarter are Dr. Alden Thompson and Dr. Jody Washburn, professors of Old Testament at Walla Walla University, and my colleagues. Have you ever wondered why Christians don't build temples, or do we build temples?
What you have in the book of Revelation, when you have everything restored, John says there was no temple there.
Yep. No need.
No need. And I think there's something universal when you move your thoughts from an earthly sanctuary to a heavenly. It's a more universal thing, whereas if you have a temple here, it tends to be much more localized. And Christians have a more expansive vision than that.
But in a way, we also long for that localization. If you think of the early development of the Christian church, from the very early, you know, time of the apostles, house churches, people met under trees, you know, we read in mm-hmm. Acts, they met together and broke bread together.
They sang hymns
by the river, right? And I think of the examples in traveling in the Holy Land. I just finished teaching biblical archaeology, and it's interesting going to a lot of these sites, whether it's Sinai, you know, where Moses met God, right? Or any number of miracles of Jesus, for instance, the bread and the fish, etc. And you look at the history of those sites, the churches that we visit today connected to those important events come from the period around and after Helena, Constantine's mom. So after this focus on Christianity, then they looked and she connected stories, traditions with space. And then people started going to that space as an act of remembrance of those events. But in another way, it changed the dynamic of how Christians worship together.
Christians would go there on a pilgrimage. They would go to these sites and they would worship there at what became a holy place because of its previous association with Jesus.
It became a temple in the sense of the space became more connected to God. So you could connect to God more easily or effectively or if you were in one of these approved spaces, rather than the idea of the New Testament, you know, where the body of people together is where God is.
Do we build temples? Would you say that as Seventh-day Adventists, we speak from a Protestant Christian tradition, we build churches, right? But we don't typically call them temples.
And there's a troubling aspect of that too, because frequently you'll have people say, you know, it is a shame to have this huge space, sanctuary, and only use it once or twice a week. Mm. See? And yet there is a sense that when a space becomes holy or sacred by whatever means, one has to be a bit careful that you don't desecrate it, if I use that term.
Mm-hmm.
So
I was taught when I was young, you don't run in the sanctuary, you don't yell and make loud noises, it's not a place to play because it was holy space. But when we read through Peter, we're going to find he's going to apply the temple language a little bit differently. He doesn't apply it to a building, building. Yeah, he'll apply it to people. So going to 1 Peter, we're in the second chapter. He begins the second chapter with some imperatives. We find a lot of moral imperatives throughout the letters. And Peter here begins this section as a conclusion of the imperatives that concluded chapter 1. He says, "Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking, as newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word, that you may grow thereby, if indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious." So he's asking us to lay aside all malice, hypocrisy, envy. In a way, that feels somewhat hypocritical to even ask me to do so. Because can I truly be clearly who I am all the time? Do we not all put on masks to some degree? Or is it possible to do what he's asking me to do, to set aside malice and deceit and hypocrisy? Can I really do that?
Is it the work of a lifetime? That's what, when I read that first verse, rid yourself of all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. My immediate response is, there's enough to keep me busy for the rest of my life. As far as what like the Sermon on the Mount, right? Heart cleansing takes
but
a long time.
But I think it's important to be able to distinguish from between our ideals and that which we strive for. There's a little few lines by a German-American, Carl Schurz, where he says, ideals are like stars. You will not be able to touch them with your hands, but like the seafaring man on the desert of the waters, you choose them as your goal, and following them, you reach your destiny.
It's beautiful.
I've actually had some students who get angry. They don't want to give up on their idealism. And yet we have to be able to distinguish between our ideals and our ability to reach those. Otherwise, we just die.
And in a sense, we think about the Alcoholics Anonymous, the prayer, the serenity prayer, right? God granting me the ability to change the things I can and the grace to accept the things I cannot.
Yeah. The wisdom to know the difference.
And so the ideal can always be up there and say, I want to, by God's grace, be honest. And it's a malice. When I think of malice, that isn't simply getting frustrated at a situation that I don't understand or can't control. That actually seems to bear some sort of enmity towards somebody in a dastardly way. And I would rather that not be part of my life.
But you know, sometimes it takes a long time. I know C.S. Lewis tells a story of praying to be able to forgive someone. And he says it was 30 years. And then suddenly he says, I woke up one morning and I realized that that man had been forgiven. See? But it was a long time in coming. And I think we have to recognize that some of these goals are wonderful goals. But as you said, Jody, it's a work of a lifetime. It'll take us quite a while.
Yeah, anytime you go beyond outward actions or beyond the words that actually go out of your mouth and you start thinking about your heart and your thoughts and
motives,
you realize, wow. I mean, I remember saying to one person a number of years ago that every time I love someone, I look up to God and say, thank you. That's a gift. That's not coming from me naturally. That's not what, you know, all that I'm made of. But boy, when I feel that love welling up in my heart, I just realize, wow, God is, he's shaping me. He's giving me that gift.
Yeah. And maybe that's part of what Peter is doing here, is simply by pointing these things out, by suggesting that we can turn from these things, he is raising the ideal and telling us something more about who God is. He, in conjunction with this, says, long for the pure milk of the word that we can grow through it. The next section, he shifts gears a little bit, and he speaks about coming to Jesus as a living stone, and his language takes up the language of temple building. You two are Old Testament specialists. Where in the Old Testament does he get this language of cornerstone and temple building? Where would I go if I wanted to read the Old Testament story of building a temple and where he's drawing his analogy from? Where would I go?
Well, the two temples that I think of, one is the earthly sanctuary, which was not a permanent temple. It was one that could be carried. But when you have Solomon's temple, then that becomes, and Solomon's prayer is a beautiful one. You know, have my people come look towards this temple and pray towards this place. So that may be the place where the language would come from.
Yeah, and I mean, he's quoting specific texts, Isaiah 28 and also Psalm 118, but I think he is drawing on a broader theology, and it shifts in the Old Testament. If you think about the tabernacle, right? Build me this so that I may dwell with my people, with the understanding that my people are moving and I'm going to go wherever they go. And then with Solomon, you have the glory of God entering the temple in this dramatic display in the dedication prayer ceremony. And then at, you know, Ezekiel, at the time of the exile, you actually have this imagery in the vision of Ezekiel of the Spirit of God leaving
The temple. The Shekinah glory departs.
And in a way, it is a message to the exiles that God is with them despite the fact they're no longer in the holy city. And it's a tension that's never completely resolved, I don't think, in the Old Testament. I mean, they come back to rebuild the temple. It's never the
same. Under Ezra and Nehemiah.
Never the same. And there's always this longing that, is God with us? Is he with us more if we have a better temple? And God always comes back with the other side of the coin, in a way, bringing people to refocus on his presence.
And isn't that the exciting part of the conclusion of the little book of Malachi, that the Lord whom you seek will come suddenly to his temple, that restoration, mm-hmm. the restoring of the Shekinah glory to the temple. And Peter has had the experience of seeing Jesus, who he believed was the Son of God, right, the presence of God with us, come into the temple, cleanses it there at the beginning of the Gospel of John. You find the story at the conclusion of the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels. But now Peter is saying that we're coming to Jesus as a living stone, rejected by men but chosen by God. We also, as living stones, are built into a spiritual house, a new sort of temple. Did Peter imply by saying this that the earthly temple was no longer sacred space, that we as believers now are a temple? And if so, what are the ramifications for that for the way we think about Israel today, Jerusalem? Should I be looking for a restored temple on the Temple Mount there? Or has something shifted with Jesus coming in regards to the temple?
Well, that was a lesson, a partial lesson that they had to learn in the Old Testament. I think of Jeremiah chapter 7, the temple discourse. People who were really rascals would run to the temple and say, "The temple, the temple, the temple of the Lord." And Jeremiah just comes and says, "No, this is not, it's not the place that makes a difference." And so the shock was that Israel had always depended upon the pilgrimages to Jerusalem and the temple. They had to learn to live without it. They went into exile. Mm. No temple.
Mm-hmm. And Peter is focusing here so much on people. I mean, not only saying we are the priesthood, but the cornerstone is a person, Jesus Christ, the embodiment of the character of God. And we join him in creating this representation of the character of God on earth.
And this means then that the temple doesn't have to be a specific geographical location. If somebody were to say, "Where's the temple?" you can say, "Well, where are the people? Let me show you the congregation. That's the sanctuary now." And then he goes on to talk about us being a royal priesthood. You mentioned that. We then, all of us, and this is maybe a challenging idea for some, men and women both, all priests within the body, and we are royal witnesses to Christ. Why don't we build temples? Well, it appears we are a temple now as the body. I'm grateful for my time with my colleagues, Alden Thompson and Jody Washburn. Next week, we're going to look at social relationships within the body of Christ, within this new temple. My thanks also to Jared Miller, who is our program engineer. And my thanks also to all of you who are listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.